Has the snowy weather kept you inside and away from local stores? It didn't stop me from heading to Boswell Books on Friday night, but then again, I had the helping hand of a friend with a Jeep Patriot. Contrary to what one might guess, the weather hasn't stopped holiday shoppers or hurt local stores. We'll have more on that story in today's Behind the Headlines. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Also in today's show, books editor Jim Higgins has read more than 100 books this year. Having read only a quarter of that, I'll take his word on what the 10 best books were this year. That's coming up later, so stay tuned. The Lincoln Hills School is a secure facility for boys and young men located in Irma, about 170 miles straight north of Madison. It opened in 1970. Last December, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported that the FBI had joined a sweeping probe of the Northwoods Institution. There were reports that the youths were not receiving adequate education. Since last December, the reports have gotten worse. One youth had to have toes amputated after an incident with a guard. Then a judge found reason to believe crimes occurred there that include sexual assault, physical child abuse, intimidation of victims and witnesses, child neglect, and abuse of prisoners. Now a year later, the Journal Sentinel is presenting two important stories. One on Sunday that traces the history of problems at Lincoln Hills, and another on Monday that examines how Missouri has taken a different approach to housing young offenders. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Tom Kircher talks with Patrick Marley. Patrick is a reporter in the Journal Sentinel's Madison Bureau.
This is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Tom Kircher. We're talking with Patrick Marley, a reporter in the Journal Sentinel's Madison Bureau, who has been covering the crisis at Lincoln Hills. Patrick, to start with, let's get a sense of the place we're talking about. Lincoln Hills is called a school, but it's a locked facility, like a prison, right?
Yeah, it's more like a prison than a school. They have these kids are between the very low teen years up to as old as 25. And so most of them are high school age and they need to get an education. So there's a school building there. That's where they attend classes. But it's a very large campus surrounded by a high chain link fence and razor wire. And then once you get into the gates, you've got a number of what they call cottages. They're dorm style facilities where smaller groups of kids stay. They get programming there. They have meals there, and then they will walk to get to the school building each day and attend classes.
Well, let's talk about the two stories that are coming up in the Journal Sentinel. Sunday's story traces the history of the problems at Lincoln Hills. Tell us about that.
It seems that many of the problems they're facing today are rooted in the move in 2011 to close Ethan Allen School, which is a similar facility in Waukesha County, and move the inmates there up to Lincoln Hills. They did the same thing with Southern Oaks Girls School, which was in Racine County, a small facility, and they created what they call Copper Lake School. It's a portion of Lincoln Hills that's devoted to girls. And this was a decision they needed to close a facility because our population of juvenile inmates had dropped considerably over the years. And so the costs were very high. They could save $25 million by going down to one institution. That happened in 2011, just after Scott Walker took over as governor. And you had this almost doubling of the population of Lincoln Hills in a very short time. And you had a mass hiring of perhaps 100 new staff members. You had inmates sort of trying to establish where they were in the pecking order. And you had some new philosophies being introduced there as to how the place should be run. And that seems to have generated many of the problems that they have today.
It sounds like taking on a lot in a short period of time. It's a simple question, maybe sounds naive, but what went wrong?
You can't point to any one thing. Mm-hmm. Certainly that seems to be where it started, was this merging of these institutions. But you had lax oversight. You had poor management. You had terrible training, in fact, where in some cases workers were actually trained to do the wrong things, trained to break up fights in the incorrect way. You had an inmate complaint process where complaints weren't getting to who they needed to get to, or at least the kids perceived that they that their complaints were being ignored. So you had all of these things sort of happening all at once. It's hard to point to any one thing that was the problem.
Sure, sure. And then on Monday, we have scheduled a story that looks at how Missouri has approached handling youth corrections. The focus there, as I understand it, is on smaller facilities rather than large ones, more of a focus on therapy. You know, since Missouri is kind of being viewed as a model or a potential model for Wisconsin,
sure.
Do we have a sense for, are they able to measure there in Missouri why that approach works better?
Well, they have, that will be a big criticism of the advocates for change will say, even if Lincoln Hills were operating perfectly and doing everything right, they would still see it as a problem because, you know, Lincoln Hills is about 30 miles north of Wausau near Merrill, Wisconsin. It's well over 200 miles away from Milwaukee. Large portion of the population at Lincoln Hills comes from Milwaukee or southeastern Wisconsin. And so you have this very large prison-like facility. There's about 145 boys there right now, about 20 girls. And so it's sort of population control. They do have programming. They do have education. But the concerns of the advocates is that those can't be addressed in the way they can in a place like Missouri, where you have a much smaller setting, a much smaller ratio of staff to inmate or resident. And so Lincoln Hills has tried to adopt some of the ideas of using less segregation, using restraints less often. But that is much harder to do when you're managing a very big population. And in a place like Missouri, you can address issues as they arise and de-escalate kids so they don't get into the kind of trouble where they would have to go to segregation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then just to wrap up, Patrick, I wonder if you could talk about what changes have been made at Lincoln Hills over the past months or a year since these problems surfaced, and then maybe what we can, you know, look forward to down the road a little bit.
Sure. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is this has been going on for quite some time. This is, we discovered the problems up there a year ago in December of 2015 when the facility got raided by 50 agents, and the investigation has since been turned over to the FBI. That's all been a year. So the investigation, by the time of the raid, the investigation had been going on for a year. So we're now 2 years into this. It was in the months after the raid that the Department of Corrections started making substantive changes. Obviously, they changed all the people who run the prison and run the Department of Corrections. There's a new secretary, a new top officials. Everybody's new except for the one sort of internal promotion was Wendy Peterson. She went from deputy superintendent to superintendent of the prison itself. They've installed 60 more cameras, surveillance cameras in the institution. They have equipped all of the workers with body cameras, and those body cameras are supposed to be on any time they have an interaction with the youth who are staying there. The Department of Corrections contends that has improved things just by the fact that they exist, because the staff have confidence that any false accusation against them will be disproven quickly, and the youth know that everything is being recorded and that they're protected if staff were to act out, that's going to be captured and that could be addressed. They have dramatically increased the amount of training they get. They now go through a 6 or 7 week course when they're first hired on the training specific to what to do at Lincoln Hills. That's much different than it was in the time of the past. I'd say those are their key changes. They've also changed their inmate complaint process and made a number of other. They've been able to hire a lot more people. They've hired about 40 staff members this year. They've had a chronic staff shortage, and that has led to very long shifts. People work in 16-hour shifts several days a week. Staff gets worn out. They've now relieved that a little bit with this hiring of more people.
Right. And just a quick follow, looking down the road a bit, any possible changes in the law or in creating smaller facilities, something that a little more long-term?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest thing that is being contemplated right now would be to build a 36-bed secure facility in Milwaukee. That would allow Milwaukee to send fewer kids to Lincoln Hills, though, as it seems that they would still have to send some there. They would be closer to home. That facility would have a little bit of a different philosophy. It's unclear what the chances are of that getting done. It would be very expensive. The governor has said that he would be willing to help pay for the building of it, but that the county would be responsible for paying for operating it. We haven't seen figures on how much this place would cost to build or to run, and we haven't heard from lawmakers yet if they'd be willing to chip in. Obviously, they would have to join the governor to do that.
The Lincoln Hills Juvenile Facility likely to be in the news for some time to come. This is Tom Kircher with Patrick Marley of the Journal Sentinel's Madison Bureau. Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Patrick and his fellow Madison reporter Jason Stein have been covering the crisis at Lincoln Hills for a year. To find the full archive of their coverage, visit jsonline.com/Lincoln Hills. Again, that's jsonline.com/Lincoln Hills. Book editor Jim Higgins is a reading powerhouse. But there were 10 books that stood out in Jim's mind this year. Reporter Sarah Hauer talked to him about which books made the cut and how he compiles the list.
Sarah Hauer here with Arts and Books editor Jim Higgins. This week he came out with his top 10 books of 2016, and he's here with me today.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Jim. So first, I'd like to hear a little bit about the books that you included in your list this year.
Sure. I read about 100 books a year. That's about half new, half older books. And so I do keep track during the year, and I really just try to come up with what are the books that most absorbed and compelled me, you know, what kept my attention and taught me something, engaged me, entertained me throughout the year. And this year's collection is 7 works of fiction, 3 works of nonfiction. That's often what about it is. I still think, from a literary point of view, there's something about fiction that has the ability to transcend the time we're in. But there's some pretty darn good nonfiction on here, too.
When you say that you keep track of the books that you read, how do you do that in a way that allows you to go back and decide what books captivated you, like you said?
The mechanical process is I use Goodreads. Goodreads is a website and service that I think Amazon bought a year or two ago. I simply log the books on Goodreads. And Goodreads has a star system, and I do give books stars. That just helps me keep track. And now I can give a book on that system 3 stars and still find it worth reading. But my 5-star criteria is, you know, total interest. I never lost interest. It kept me going. I wanted to keep going back to it. And often, end of the year, I look through the 5 stars. And I'll sometimes have more than 10, but it's pretty easy to do the bulk of the list by just going back and thinking, here are my 5-star books.
One of the books that was on your list and has gotten a lot of attention is Evicted. It's also the only one on your list that I've read.
Well, then you chose well, Young Jedi. Evicted by Matthew Desmond is a nonfiction book about poverty in Milwaukee. Desmond is now at Harvard sociologist. He spent more than a year in Milwaukee studying the relationship between eviction and poverty. And to do that, he lived and spent a lot of time at a Southside trailer park and in a Northside rooming house and got to know. It's a classic participant observer study. He got to know the people. He spent enough time there that, to a large extent, they were able to live their lives without focusing too much on the fact that he was studying them. And he just really writes compelling narratives about, you know, the dilemmas people in poverty get into when they lose their home. I mean, so many things depend on having an address, you know, being able to get a job, being able to get certain kinds of benefits, being contacted for court proceedings. When you don't have an address, you have trouble accessing those parts of the social service safety net.
So while it was an academic work, what did you find about it that was so captivating?
He's a great storyteller, and he really just captured the dilemmas of these folks. And in the way a good novel would be, the characters aren't cartoonishly black and white. You know, we can be sympathetic reading the book with the people being evicted, but they have their problems. They make their bad mistakes and their dumb decisions, too. And he writes about a couple of landlords who own some of these horrible places, but he doesn't paint them as total villains either. You know, he makes everybody a complex character. Yeah, he just fully depicts people in their humanity.
So now let's talk about one of the works of fiction that you selected for this year. Which one would you say piqued your interest?
Well, I've been telling people my 1 and 1A books for the year are Evicted and The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead, and I'm not the only one on Whitehead's novel. He basically writes about a woman escaping from a horrific slavery plantation, and his imaginative thing is to depict the Underground Railroad, the process by which slaves were smuggled north, escaping slaves. He depicts it as a real railroad. And when I read those descriptions before I read the book, I kind of wondered, okay, how jokey is this or how goofy is this? He does it in a very realistic way within that narrative concept, that these different railroad stations, which are deep underground, are dilapidated and run by goofy, crazy volunteers, and some are dead ends, and you never know when a station might close down. So he executes this extremely well. And there's also a sense in which he suggests that the work of escaping to freedom is not finished. And I don't want to give that away, but there's a way in which he writes metaphorically in this that suggests that the Underground Railroad is still being built. And so it feels like a writer hitting his peak found the perfect subject and the perfect way to write about it. So the only thing I'll say is don't read the North Carolina chapter before you go to bed. That's pretty harrowing.
I'm curious to know, were there any books that you want to throw out there as kind of honorable mentions that you couldn't quite put them in your top 10, but you still want to recommend them to our friends listening?
If you're into football, I was very high on 2 football biographies this year. One is called Chuck Knoll, His Life's Work by Michael McCambridge. It's a biography of the Pittsburgh Steelers coach who won 4 Super Bowl titles in the 70s and has both things in common and opposed to Vince Lombardi. So football folks would like that. Also very high on Octavia E. Butler by a Marquette professor, Jerry Canavan, which is about the great writer Octavia Butler. It's a wonderful study of her work. And A Life Discarded, 148 Diaries Found in the Trash by Alexander Masters. Alexander Masters is a British writer who writes unusual biographies about regular people. He wrote one about a homeless neighbor. He wrote one about his savantish landlord. And this book started when a friend of his in a dumpster found 148 diaries that someone had kept for decades. And he turned them over to Alexander. Alexander tried to figure out who the person was from the diaries and, you know, came up with ideas, and of course they were wrong, but kept getting closer to the truth. And to his surprise, he eventually met the person who was still alive who wrote all these diaries. This book is his attempt to write that person's biography and what those diaries meant to that person. And so that's a really off-the-beaten-path book. And he's a really enjoyable writer, and he's also a doodler who doodles little illustrations in the book, too.
To find out about the other books on Jim's list, visit tapmilwaukee.com. You'll also find lists from theater reviewer Mike Fisher and crime novel aficionado Carol Barrowman. Again, those are available at tapmilwaukee.com. From polar vortex temps to snowy days, holiday shoppers in Wisconsin have had every reason to stay inside and shop online. One would think this mix of weather would mean bad things for retailers, but that's not necessarily the case. Here's reporter Tom Dakin talking to business reporter Joe Tashler on the way retailers are staying afloat this winter.
I'm Tom Dakin, business reporter here, and I'm joined by my colleague, Joe Tashler, who is a... What's your title anyway? Are you a business editor or a business reporter? Are you both?
I'm both.
You're both. You're like a shape-shifting type guy. All right. Anyway, we're talking this week about Joe's magnificent story about shopping and why if you go out this weekend in the cold, snowy weather, it will kill you. Take it away, Joe.
Well, typically at this time of the year, the last full weekend before the Christmas holiday is the busiest shopping weekend of the year. And, of course, we're all set to get somewhere between 7 and 100 inches of snow and with wind chills down to 30 below zero by Saturday night. So you would think that retailers would be not too happy about having weather kind of wreck their store traffic, but I found out the exact opposite. They're actually, for the first time in a couple of winters, selling all kinds of boots, hats, gloves, coats, scarves, long underwear, and
electric socks.
Yes. And it's been this weather's been good for
why has this horrible weather been good for these guys?
You know, the apparel sales for the past two Christmases or Christmas shopping seasons, which encompass the months of November and December, have been down. And all the forecasts I'm hearing is they're actually going to be up this year. And I've got talked to one retail consultant who says it could be up by as much as $550 million.
Because really cold weather, bad weather makes you buy warm weather or clothing that keeps you warm, right? That's the idea.
Exactly.
Okay.
You've got to stay warm.
Yes.
And you know, if you've been putting off the purchase of the coat and the boots and the hat, when the wind chill hits 30 below zero, you got to have it.
True story. Zipper on my awesome North Face jacket broke yesterday. This would be on Wednesday. It was cold on Wednesday. So I dropped it in at the place today to get the zipper repaired, local dry cleaner.
Yeah.
10 business days, sir. So, you know, okay, that's fine. I'll die of exposure. No problem. But they don't care about my problems. Let's see.
You can borrow one of my coats, Tom.
Thanks. That's cool of you. But people, the other thing is online shopping. You don't need to go out in the cold, right?
Well, that's just it. A lot of the retailers are insulated somewhat from a big snowstorm impacting the traffic at their brick and mortar stores because mm-hmm. people can stay home in their fuzzy pajamas and order online, mm-hmm. and so that's you know, a big snowstorm on the busiest shopping day of the year 25 or 30 years ago might have been just a huge problem mm-hmm. for your brick-and-mortar retailers. Not so much this time around.
But I think you note in your story that for chain retailers, Kohl's, Macy's, they're all over the place. So obviously they might have – if some stores are affected by bad weather, they got other stores that will do just fine. But what if you're a small retailer? You have one or two locations, three locations. They're all in the same area. You might then have a bigger impact.
Sure. If you're a small retailer with a couple of storefronts and no real online presence and you were expecting a big day Saturday, yeah, you might have to you might have cause for concern.
Yeah.
But like you said, a Kohl's, a Macy's, the stores coast to coast. Now, this cold snap goes all the way down to North Texas, according to the Weather Service, so it's cold everywhere. But just the real nasty snow and wind is confined across the upper Midwest.
Okay. And one more question. This is probably the most important question. If the weather is this bad on Christmas Eve, what's Santa going to do?
Well, you know,
I saw this documentary one time where he came really close to postponing Christmas, but this reindeer with a bright, shiny red nose saved him. Yeah, I think it was a Michael Moore production or something. But anyway,
well, he's got the reindeer with the red nose, which is kind of an infrared type system that can go through any kind of weather.
That's great.
And the sleigh's got Doppler radar, so it can go around thunderstorms.
So for all the young children who inevitably are listening to this podcast, it's cool. Don't worry about it, kids.
Everything's going to be good.
Everything's going to be fine.
Yep. Okay. It might be snowing and cold, but you know, Santa's good. The sleigh's ready to go. Rudolph's ready to go.
Yes.
We'll be tracking them on radar Christmas Eve night.
Joe's story ran in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel earlier this week. You can find it online at jsonline.com/business. That does it for today's show. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in next week for a special Christmas surprise, and take care until then.